creation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds that live nearby all die. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more abuse from man can she stand?
Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program. I'm your host today, Robert Jones. On the program, a really interesting and spirited discussion on the issue of environmentalism and the role that the working class should play in environmentalism. We'll speak today with two scholars of environmentalism. We'll speak to Matt Huber, who has a new book coming out called Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet, and John Sanban Matsu, who has a forthcoming book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life. Stick around. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program. I'm actually here conducting an interview via Zoom with my two guests today, and they are Matt Huber is a professor of geography and the environment at Syracuse University. He's the author of the 2013 book, Lifeblood, Oil, Freedom, and the Forces of Capital. His new book, Climate Change as Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet, will be out in May of 2022 from Verso Books. Matt is also the author of many articles and popular press articles. And I became familiar with his work through a few articles. One was in this past February, an article in Jacobin, which was called Lifestyle Environmentalism Will Never Win Over Workers. And another article in Catalyst from 2019 called Ecological Politics for the Working Class. Those are great articles, and you can check those out online. I'm also joined by John Sanban Matsu, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Mm. He is the author of The Postmodern Prince, Critical Theory, Left Strategy, and the Making of a New Political Subject, and the editor of the book, Critical Theory and Animal Liberation. A leading critic of cellular or cultivated meat, John created and now curates the www.cleanmeat-hoax.com website. He is currently at work on a new book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life. Matt and John, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Thanks for having us, Robert.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So, Matt, I want to start with you, and I want to start just to give you a background. You know, our listeners, most of our listeners on the program are involved, you know, in some kind of activities that they believe are reducing their carbon footprint, and most of our listeners are pretty conscientious when it comes to environmental issues. I'm wondering for the layperson, if you could lay out what you do so well in these articles that I've referenced. There's this thing you call lifestyle environmentalism, and a large part of your work is a critique of lifestyle environmentalism, and that was one of the things that attracted me to your work, was a lack of a critique of these kinds, where what I need to do as an individual consumer or as a sovereign consumer is if I change, specifically decrease my consumption, then that is some kind of solution to our global climate crisis. But you, of course, have a different take on this. And I'm wondering if you could just lay out the basics for the layperson. What is this, first of all, what is this thing that you're calling lifestyle environmentalism? And how does this fit into, you know, activism that, you know, people on the left who want to contribute to decreasing climate catastrophe, how does that fit into their lives?
All right. First of all, I think the more kind of common sense understanding is that lifestyle environmentalism is a sort of form of politics where people feel like they express their environmental politics through consumer choices and through lifestyle choices, and that they feel that as a really impactful way to make a difference in the world. I try to kind of take a step back from that narrow definition to define it as a mode of thinking about politics and the environmental crisis that really roots the problem in what we might call mass consumption or consumer lifestyles or even the American way of life or sort of post-war consumerism and these types of patterns of consumption. And essentially, I try to link that understanding to a specific kind of ecological way of actually measuring and investigating those impacts, which is known as ecological footprint analysis, but can be translated to kind of carbon footprint analysis. And those sort of methods and metrics really do kind of center the consumer as the agent whose consumption kind of can be traced back to specific environmental impacts. And so footprint analysis kind of says, you know, if you consume this way, it takes this many hectares or this many acres of space to sustain your way of living. Carbon footprint can calculate your consumptive practices in terms of emissions or pounds of carbon dioxide. Essentially, I don't know if you want me to get into the critique of it, but essentially by centering consumers, you know, that does make sense from an ecological point of view. You know, you go into any ecosystem and it's really organisms that are the consumers of matter and energy, and they are the ones driving environmental change in an ecosystem. But humans, unfortunately, are subjected to class forms of control over resources. And actually the real, you know, from a socialist or Marxist perspective, the real operators in a capitalist class system are those, not the consumers, but the people that own and control production, the people that own and direct that production towards profit. And it's them who really are core actors in all of our consumption. So it's very strange that footprint analysis puts all the responsibility for emissions and environmental impacts on consumers when each moment of consumption can actually be traced back to a for-profit producer who's actually making money off that transaction and off those environmental impacts. And really the consumers, even if they're really wealthy and they're extremely profligate, they are just provisioning their needs in a consumptive economy. It's really the other end of the supply chain where you have finance capital, industrial capital, who are making all the money off this consumption. And I feel like the footprint analysis really directs our attention away from those owners, from the capitalists who actually control the economy and profit from it. And that's who we really need to target, because they're the ones preventing us from solving the ecological crisis.
Well, Matt Huber, you write, I'm going to quote you. You write, quote, "Much consumption, like driving, is not a choice, but a necessity of social reproduction. For example, getting to work. Moreover, when we choose commodities, we can only choose those that are profitable to produce in the first place. A contradiction of environmentally sustainable commodities with lower footprints is that they are often more expensive." So I think that touches on the heart, kind of the heart of what you're saying. Can you say more about that? So the average person, we have the lifestyle, and we have, and this connects, of course, as you do to the politics. But the average, say, you know, here we are in Chico, California. There are a lot of environmentally friendly leftists here listening to the program. So they're thinking, well, look, I drive a Prius, and then when I go to the store, I buy organic, and I try not to buy, high impact goods. I might go to, you know, I might go to the local co-op. So this vision that we've adopted our politics, what you call, or what we call, the consumer sovereignty model. Mm. It looks like what you're saying is, part of this, is it illusory that I think that by doing these things, I'm going to have an impact. And really what's going on is any choice that I make is really, sort of predetermined by the corporate sector with regard to which commodities are profitable. Can you say a little bit more about how that picture works?
Yeah, I think what makes it such an attractive political avenue for us is capitalism actually doesn't give us a lot of control over the economy and our lives. We're forced to work 8, 10, 12 hours a day for someone else to make the money we need to live. But capitalism does give us control in the market, and it does allow us to make choices in our consumption. And so it's perfectly understandable that people want to feel like in that very narrow realm, they have agency, they have control, they have choices to make. My only point is that that realm is not really it's not anywhere close to the control center. You could call it the command center of the capitalist economy, which are, again, a small class of owners who really direct it towards profit. And moreover, as you hinted in that quote, these types of ecologically conscious choices typically are more expensive, typically are the purview of a heavily privileged, affluent consumer. Often, as I detail in the piece, you know, very sort of professional, upper middle class types of people that engage in this kind of virtuous low carbon or virtuous ecological consumption. And in my view, what that kind of does is create these little privileged enclaves of feel good consumption, whereas most of the capitalist economies just hums along, where the core power centers, the command centers, continue to not be challenged because all these people think they're actually making politics or doing politics through the market or through consumption. And that, you know, at the best level, you can say that these make, you know, really, they make impacts because people are consuming less fuel, or they're consuming food that's from more ecological production processes. But a more kind of maybe cynical interpretation is that these consumption practices just allow a small privileged few to feel good about themselves, while the crisis itself just keeps getting worse, and the people responsible for it get off the hook because everyone thinks it's all about consumption.
So Matt Huber, let me pick up on something you write in the article, extending this conversation, and that is with regard to the class aspects. I mean, there's a number of arguments that you go through, and one is what we just spoke about, which is I'd say a theoretical analysis of the relations, the class politics involved. But there's also the expedient aspects that I want you to speak to, which is getting the working class on board with these kinds of ecological politics, right? And so, of course, we always hear, and you write about this, you know, we hear about whenever there's an example would be the Green New Deal, and there's some proposals about cutting back on fossil fuels, and then we have the working class, union members, or people who are involved in those industries, they're opposed to these kinds of plans. And so there's a question about how do how do we work in solidarity with the working class while at the same time getting them on board with this, the urgency of climate crisis?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. So taking a step back to what we were talking about before, which is this sort of mode of politics called lifestyle environmentalism, which really sees all consumption as kind of inherently impactful and leading to environmental degradation. If you link that to a very standard kind of Marxist definition of who is the working class, which is it's a class of people who, to survive, have to rely on a wage or money and commodities to basically reproduce their everyday lives. So you can see how this kind of footprint analysis and lifestyle environmentalism just sort of takes a working class person and fixates on their means of survival, which is consumption through the market, and sort of villainizes that as the main problem. So you can understand why that might not appeal to large masses of working class people. Number two, we've lived through 4 decades of neoliberalism, which has been defined by wage stagnation, mounting debt, increasing economic insecurity on the part of the mass of working class people, even in global North countries, where people are really, really struggling to get by economically. So again, a kind of politics that sort of highlights how you need to consume less or become more virtuous in your consumption products, which might lead to higher cost commodities. It's not going to appeal to those masses of people who are really, really struggling. And so we need, you know, a politics that would appeal to the masses of working class struggling people would more be about gains. You know, a classic, socialist politics that centers material gains of the working class. And when it comes down to it, particularly along the climate crisis, you know, the very sectors that we really need to decarbonize and transform are things like transportation, they're things like food, and most importantly, they're things like electricity and energy. These are all at the core of working class needs, material needs, the things they need to survive on a daily basis. So instead of making those material needs about consuming less and doing more with less or some sort of austerity politics, you know, a Green New Deal or a radical politics that centered kind of making access to those needs more secure, you know, and better, cheaper access. The key one is electricity, which is at the core of any decarbonization challenge, centering really cheaper electricity, maybe even more radical proposals for decommodifying these core needs, so, which is one reason why Green New Deal activists really wanted to attach a Green New Deal politics to Medicare for All, which is ultimately about decommodifying healthcare in this godforsaken country where people still have to go into hundreds of thousands of medical debt just to go to the hospital or something like that. But really expanding decommodification to these core material needs that need to be decarbonized is kind of a politics, a very different type of politics than that lifestyle environmentalism. Now, the other question you ask is really about unions and the fact that a lot of particularly industrial unions have been somewhat hostile to environmentalists in general. And then, unfortunately, the AFL-CIO, at least the national version, came out against the Green New Deal because of a certain, really, they were feeling like they weren't really part of the conversation in launching it. But ultimately, a lot of environmental politics is very much opposed to a lot of industrial development. It's often opposed to a lot of, heavily unionized sectors. And so the only answer that we can have for that is essentially just to, again, if we look at what needs to happen to solve the ecological and climate crisis, it's going to require a massive expansion of production, of new kinds of infrastructure, And this is kind of what Biden is all about now. You know, new, we need to build a new clean energy economy, and it's going to be good unionized jobs. At least he says it is. but actually, it's very clear that we could make this decarbonization process about centering industrial unions, centering particularly the fact that, you know, electric utility sector is already one of the more union dense sectors of the entire economy. So why not make them the real linchpin, the real centerpiece of decarbonization strategy? These are the workers that know electricity better than anyone else in the economy, because they work on the lines, they work in the power plants, they work. And so it's not totally inconceivable to imagine a industrial union-led decarbonization process. Unfortunately, sometimes a lot of the actors and advocates of environmental policies, even with the Green New Deal, tend to kind of avoid these industrial unions and not really make them a core part of the coalition or a core part of the strategy in achieving the changes we need to see.
That's the voice of Matt Huber, professor of geography and the environment at Syracuse University. I'm also here joined by John Sabnamatsu, professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Before we move on, I need to let you know that Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by regional and continuing education at Chico State, featuring online career training for jobs in the growing and in-demand fields of healthcare, construction, and trades. From medical billing and coding to HVAC technicians to veterinary assistants, there's a wide range of options, interests, and skill sets. Visit rce.csuchico.edu to learn more. Peace and Justice is also brought to you by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit chicocourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. Well, you're tuned to the Peace and Social Justice program right here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. I have with me via Zoom Matt Huber, professor of geography and the environment at Syracuse University. He's the author of Lifeblood, Oil, Freedom, and the Forces of Capital, and he has a new book coming out in 2022 on Verso, Climate Change as Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet. I'm also fortunate to have with us John Sabnamatsu, professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute and the author of The Postmodern Prince, Critical Theory, Left Strategy, and the Making of a New Political Subject. He is also the editor of the book Critical Theory and Animal Liberation. He is a leading critic of cellular or cultivated meat, and he is currently working on a new book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life. John, can you give you've heard the kind of general picture, and I know that we've spoken, you and I, a little bit about Matt's work. I'm wondering what your response, so if you can reflect on some of the stuff that we've heard today.
Sure. You know, I completely agree with what you were saying, Matt, certainly about a kind of voluntarism that we find in society at large and including among liberals and some leftists, you know, the idea that we can overcome structural and in this case macroeconomic, you know, problems through individual consumption, you know, changing our consumption. And we see this within the animal rights and vegan community, for example, the idea, well, if I just become a vegan, then that's my contribution and it's political and that will somehow bring change about. And that said, I am a vegan and I advocate that. And I guess I have a few comments. One is that, so I completely agree with what Matt was saying about the kind of illusion that simply changing one's consumption patterns is anywhere near sufficient. It may be, in fact, a necessary condition for real social transformation, which I'll get to, but certainly not, maybe necessary, but certainly not a sufficient condition. That said, I want to say that consumption, so Matt is absolutely right, that production is the point of production is where we need to look at power dynamics, including class domination. And that's, you know, that's the start of the commodity logic is production. However, consumption is not merely the tail on the dog. Consumption is part of a dialectical unity with production. And we can't, therefore, understate the importance of production, both materially and ideologically, it seems to me. Consumption is crucial to the material reproduction of capital, to completing the circuit of capital. And also more and more in the 20th century and now into the 21st, it's to the ideological reproduction of capital.
Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by the ideological production of capital?
The ideological reproduction.
Reproduction of capital.
In other words, in other words, for capital, capitalism to maintain, it has to legitimate itself. In the 19th century, it was much clearer, much more obvious to a lot of people, certainly in the working class, what the problem was. I mean, you could just see, I mean, there's just the terrific public poverty, you know, in Manchester, when Engels description of textile mills in Manchester, you know, up on the hill, right, overlooking them with these huge mansions and so on. So the mediations of the cultural and ideological and semiotic mediations of capital have become more complex, and power is somewhat more hidden, I would argue, than it has been in the past. And, the whole point of the Western Marxist tradition, and in particular the Frankfurt School, was to come to terms with the fact that the working class did not bring about revolution in the West, brought about, you know, in highly industrialized societies. The first revolution occurred in Russia, which was largely peasant-based, you know, et cetera. So one thing that Adorno and Horkheimer in particular emphasize, for example, in the culture their essay, The Culture Industry, is the extent to which the working class has been, in a sense, bought off, or at the very least, incorporated within the machinery of capital, not just obviously functionally, strategically, because the whole system is on their shoulders. Working class could destroy capitalism tomorrow if it just went on a general strike. Why hasn't it gone on general strike after five centuries? Well, that's a question. Why is it that, you know, union membership has been declining and declining and declining? Why is it that working class militancy has been declining and declining and declining, so that the most that unions will talk about is getting a larger share of the pie or increasing gains, which, by the way, is to remain trapped within the ideology of capital itself, which is egoistic. What's in it for me? Am I going to get a bigger piece of the pie? I want to have a Caddy someday. I want to have a Cadillac. I want to have everything that the rich people have. So this is where ideology and culture are crucial. They're not merely, you know, we think of superstructure. We think of culture and ideology and ideas and moral life, superstructure. Well, Marx had a complex dialectical view of superstructure. It wasn't just at the base, like mechanically determined superstructure. Superstructure is intertwined with the base, with the economic production apparatus. So it's pointless to talk about, it seems to me pointless to just talk about changing ownership of production in the abstract. We have to look at on the ground of ideology, politics, and so forth. And so the question I guess I'd have for Matt is, you know, to what extent can we really infinitely defer these questions of values, which is to say how to live a human life? Because I totally agree that that quote lifestyle environmentalism can be a cop-out, but it also can be an example of great moral courage on the part of the individual. It can be an example of self-sacrifice, of solidarity with other suffering beings, whether animals or poor people in the developing world, etc. But we have a very sordid history of the left for over 100 years of deferring questions of ethics and values. And then guess what happens? Well, then we end up with Stalinism and Maoism and so forth. So it's not sufficient to just say, well, working class just needs to struggle for more material goods, because of course that's really crucial. But if we're not also talking about ecological values, and not ecological values in terms of self-interest or egoistic need, but of compassion for all living beings, respect for nature as an other that cannot and should not be incorporated into human design, which is assumed by Marxists in every single stripe, almost every single stripe, the idea that nature is there just for us. To me, there's no chance of developing a proper democratic ecological politics. And the last thing I'll say is I do think what, you know, Troy Vitese calls eco-austerity is inevitable, because in fact, capitalism is not the only problem in the world. It just isn't. I mean, human domination over and mass killing of other beings, other sensitive beings, other intelligent sensitive beings precedes capitalism by thousands of years. And critique of human domination and killing of other beings precedes capitalism by thousands of years, just as patriarchy precedes capitalism by thousands of years. So again, these are questions of values, how to live a human life. Do we want to live a life in which we dominate and murder our fellow beings? Well, that question cannot be answered simply by articulating a politics of increased material gain. There's a surplus, as it were, that's very much about defining a new form of civilizational life, a new way of being human. So those are some of my, I guess, initial observations about that.
That's the voice of John Sanban Matsu. You're listening to the Peace and Social Justice Program here on KZFR 90.1 FM. Matt, I want to throw it over to you. John sure did put a lot out there to digest. I wonder if you, what are your reflections? What are your responses to some of those insightful points that John made?
Yeah, it is really important. I think the very concerning thing for a Marxist or a socialist is the fact of what John pointed out, that despite our hopes and predictions, the working class has not for decades really built the kind of power to really build like what John Kenneth Galbraith called a countervailing power to capital, let alone create a world revolution. But I tend to take the position that this, class struggle is something that wanes and changes throughout the history of capitalism. And we're clearly in a period of what David Harvey called neoliberalism, what he called it, the restoration of class power. So we're in a period of many decades where the capital and capitalist class has been waging a class war and winning, as Warren Buffett once said. He said, "My class is waging it and we're winning." And that's been bleak for people that believe in working class politics for several decades. But a Marxist analysis of capitalism does believe that despite the working class, even if it's being crushed, even if it's being defeated, it has some capacities that no other social actor really has. And for me, despite all the crisis we're seeing with democracy right now, and despite all the problems, I believe that socialism is fundamentally about democracy, and therefore working class is, any way you want to slice it, is the vast majority of society. You know, I recommend a great book called The Working Class Majority. For some reason, I'm blanking on, Michael Zweig. And he just, you know, even with taking out sort of professional class, managerial class, you know, you get about 2/3 of society being in this working class. And that, you know, just if we believe in democracy, we're going to have to win over that mass. You know, we need a kind of mass politics that can, again, build that kind of counterpower to take on the people who really control society, which are the capitalists and the owners and the super rich, and have really only widened their control and domination of society again over the last few decades. So I do think the Frankfurt School theory of a working class being bought off, and, you know, theories of kind of the trade union bureaucracy and the labor aristocracy, you know, those made a lot of sense maybe in the 1950s and 60s, where unions were powerful and there was a serious sort of Keynesian welfare state. But after four decades of massive neoliberal assault and austerity, I don't think we can really look at that bottom 2/3 of even the U.S. society as bought off or privileged or kind of basking in consumer gluttonous abundance, right? Most people can't even afford basic healthcare. A third of people in the United States struggle to pay their utility bills. I've seen measures that are as high as 60, sometimes 80% people live paycheck to paycheck. So people are really struggling. But I think the more significant questions John raises are the really most important ones, which is, how do we implement our values and our ethics in the world, in the ecological world, through different, basically setting up different arrangements with how we live with the world. And that, to me, should be at the core of what someone would call ecological socialism. But to me, and again, a Marxist perspective believes that in order to enact our values and our ethics in the ecological world, we actually need more power over how we produce the very basic subsistence of life, of everyone's life. And unfortunately, in capitalism, that control and that ownership over how we produce the means of subsistence is controlled by capital for the most part. There are little parts of life that are controlled by publicly owned state enterprises in some cases, but for the most part, you know, if you take the food industry, for instance, it's just completely controlled by capital, and they're only controlling it for profit. And then you see how they control it for profit, and you see how they treat animals, you see how they treat, you know, landscapes as just sort of mechanisms for profit making. But if we want to express our ethics, express values, more democratic values, we need to actually try to erode that power of capital and build this counterpower to actually direct and control production for more ethical aims that aren't profit, that are other things that matter. For respect for nature, respect for other living beings, that stuff, if we want to enact that, we need power, because capital has all the power now. My understanding of Troy Vitesse's essay is that I'm not sure if he thinks eco-austerity is inevitable, but he's very clearly advocating for what he calls egalitarian eco-austerity. And to me, to do that in an age of neoliberal already existing austerity, it's not going to have the capacity to build that counterpower. It's not going to really help inspire and mobilize a mass base for your politics. You know, he has a new book coming out that in the catalog description suggests that it should include not just veganism as something we should try to do as individuals, but compulsory veganism. And I'm sure John would probably not agree with this, but I just don't see how a program of compulsory veganism has any capacity to win over masses of people in a society where, for better or worse, most people sort of associate human dietary needs with that kind of omnivore meat eating, dairy eating practices. And so I totally agree. I would love a sort of ecologically socialist form of production that could completely abolish the kind of CAFOs and the kind of factory farms that we see today. Because I don't think anyone that's trying to organize production for social and ecological needs would organize it in that way, factory farms and CAFOs. But I'd like to think we could have an ecological socialism that could develop respectful, sustainable relationships with animals and landscapes that doesn't necessarily have to have compulsory veganism as the kind of core demand around it.
That's the voice of Matt Huber. He's the author of a new book coming out in 2022, Climate Change as Class War, coming out on Verso. I'm also here joined via Zoom by John Sandman Matsu, who has a book coming out. He's working on a book called The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat Animals and the Nature of Moral Life. You're tuned to the Peace and Social Justice Program on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. I need to let you know that the Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org. You can find them on Facebook or give them a call at 762-1490. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by the bankruptcy law offices of Michael O. Hayes, that's H-A-Y-S, a proud supporter of community radio. For more than 40 years, Michael O. Hayes has provided consultations for Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcies. You can reach Michael O. Hayes, spelled H-A-Y-S, at 892-8916 and online at mhayeslaw.com. That's mhayeslaw.com. Well, thanks to our underwriters for supporting community radio and in particular, the Peace and Social Justice Program. So, John Sandman Matsu. So a couple of questions. So there's this reference to Troy Vitesse's sort of ecological austerity and this. I'm willing to bet that for many listeners, the very phrase compulsory veganism evokes a kind of Big Brother and this scary kind of government intervention. So John, I'm wondering if you can speak to that and some of the other things that Matt pointed out.
Yeah, I haven't read Troy Vitesse's new co-authored book. And so I'm not familiar with the term compulsory veganism. I guess unless it means simply universal veganism or like, which I would be in favor of. Compulsory, if that's like vaccine mandates, that's not going to go over too well. You know, the government's going to put you in jail for not becoming a vegan. Like, that's all we need. Okay. That's no one is talking about that, folks, radio listeners. You know, let us not spread the rumor that they're coming for your guns first and your burgers next. Right. In fact, there is this anxiety that's very, tied to masculinity and in particular working class masculinity in many cases around defense of meat. There are these meat wars, cultural meat wars going on with the red states rallying around hunting and having access to cheap flesh. So kidding aside, I mean, that is an issue. I think, Matt, that what you were doing there is partly, I totally hear you, and of course you're right, that something like veganism universal or otherwise, seems like a political non-starter. And you emphasize the need to that, you know, to gain power. The left has to gain power. So the question is, how do we build a movement, a coalition that's broad-based enough that we can get enough people on board that we can have power? So we're on the same page there. I mean, I, as Robert, you know, I consider myself a Gramscian, and my first book was largely about Gramsci. And Gramsci, of course, talks about building a counter-hegemonic bloc. The thing is that Gramsci also is that the idea of the counter-hegemonic bloc is based on what Gramsci calls moral and intellectual leadership. And Gramsci conceived social change as a struggle over values, you know, over moral and intellectual life. It is wrong morally, and it's wrong intellectually to abandon a position because it's unpopular. Women are oppressed in every society in the world. Misogyny is the norm in every society in the world. That is not a reason for the left not to center feminism, feminist values, women's equality, and its actions. Likewise, the fact that in every society in the world, humans have contempt for other life forms, violent contempt, to the point where we kill between 1 and 3 trillion animals every year. We're wiping, and because of that, by the way, because of animal agriculture and the fisheries industries, we're wiping out all the other animals on the earth. Human exploitation and domination of other animals is the leading cause of biodiversity loss and the mass species extinction crisis. It's much more serious even than global warming. So it's, as I say, it's intellectually dishonest and, in my view, radically immoral to abandon the field of that I've described and others have described as, you know, within critical animal studies as anti-speciesism, which is a mouthful to describe a system of domination, a material system of, or mode of production that precedes capitalism is now intertwined with it. So I think, again, getting back to the question of consumption, I think it's really important to distinguish between forms of modes of desired modes of consumption and desired modes of production. It is not enough for us to just say, well, we want to have control over the means of production. Production for what? What kinds of things are we going to produce? The people, I totally appreciate your point, Matt, about, you know, I was mentioning the culture industry, and I might have also mentioned Marcuse, you know, writing in the 60s amidst a kind of abundance, right, because of the labor capital compromise and working class wages rising. So it is a very different context. I grant you that. But in the working class folks I know, they really do want to be proper bourgeois. They want to have everything that they see on in celebrity culture. They want to be millionaires, and they think they can be. Or if they can't be millionaires, they at least want to be able to have a huge closet full of 500 different shoes. Again, that's the consumption that mass consumer culture is actually something, and it really does matter that people want feel that they have a natural right to have that kind. They can look up at the hill there or whatever in their mind. They want to be able to have a steak every night or whatever. They want to have their meat. But as Wolfgang Haug, the German Marxist, writes in his book Commodity Aesthetics, right, the commodities, and he describes it as an anthropological project, to say the consumption regime gets into our skulls and our everyday way of thinking about the world and distorts our view of everything. So if we're talking about building working class consciousness, we have to decommodify and de-reify the minds of everyone, including the working class, and change the way we think about things like luxury goods, endless consumption, mindless consumption, and the way we view other animals. Now, Matt, you mentioned CAFOs and so forth. Well, the reason that animals are treated as horribly as they are is because it's simply a math problem. If you're going to feed, you know, 8 billion human beings the flesh of billions and billions of animals who have to be killed in order for that to happen, then you're going to have to create mass means of production. And in order to do that, you're going to have efficiency ratios and so forth. So I really want to push back against the idea that we can, that one can seek the violent destruction of another being respectfully. There's no such thing. The problem with the way we treat other animals is not factory farming. It's that we view their lives as worthless. And it's because of that, that everything else follows. So, the deeper we look into human civilization, I think, you know, we really come up against some very dark things about our species, including the gendered nature of desire within this kind of sadomasochistic patriarchal culture and context. And we find a will to domination that's existential. We want to be able to think of ourselves as the superior being on the earth, and in fact, the only animal that matters. So again, you know, I think I think the main difference maybe between us here is that I totally acknowledge, Matt, your very important points about production and building a movement, mass movement. But I also think that there is something that we might call human species imperialism, what I've called human species right, which is the idea that any human has a right to appropriate and exploit all other living beings on the earth. And that is fundamentally the driving cause of the ecological crisis, in my view. It's inseparable from capitalism, but capitalism is not the only problem here, in my view.
Oh, John Sabin-Matsu, I want to touch on something that Matt Huber said with regard to your point about human values, and as you brought up earlier, part of the problem is a problem on the left of ethics and centering how to live a good life. And so, can you speak to Matt's point? I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, your point was that there to sort of implement these kinds of values requires power. You can't do this from a position of being subordinate and having no power. So I didn't, again, Matt, if I'm wrong, I mean, I didn't hear Matt disagreeing that there has to be a kind of transformation in values. It's just to implement them requires, so it's sort of like are we putting the cart before the horse? We have these values, do we get in power and then implement them, or do we somehow transform these kinds of these working class values, John, that you're talking about, this aspirations for material affluence, transform them, and then what's the story? You know, what's your response, I guess, in this sense of Matt saying, it seems like Matt saying you have to have power first. It seems like you might be saying you have to have transformation first. Can you help clarify that?
Yeah, I mean, Gramsci's idea of revolution is that when the left is at the point, or the Vanguard Party, whatever, the left is at the point of assuming state power, you know, and is in control of the power structures of society. It's like a ripe fruit just falling off the tree. I mean, it's already happened. The revolution has, in a sense, already occurred because you've transformed the ground of meaning. We've transformed the value structure in such a way that people see the world differently, and they see it from your point of view. So let's, leaving aside ecological issues and animal issues, just take the question of socialism, which, by the way, is a very unpopular position. So if we were to like say, oh, well, we should only promote values in a politics that most people agree with, then socialism would not be on the agenda. Most people are not down with overthrowing capitalism right now, you know. But if we can get them to see it that way, if we can explain that capitalism is inimical to ethics, to decency, to a livable world, and so forth, then we build a movement. But I don't think Matt, that you're saying this, but I think that what we clearly cannot advocate is a movement that is just going to seek to achieve power in some abstract sense and then get real. I mean, this is kind of like the way liberals projected hopes onto Obama, you know, like, oh, well, Obama or Clinton, actually Bill Clinton, same thing. These, you know, they're really secretly radicals. And then when they get into power, They're just saying the things they need to say in order to say, you know, in order to get into power. And then once they're in power, super radical, then they're going to like reveal, it doesn't work like that. We know this. And we know this from, again, the horrible, violent, bloody history of the left, okay, for over 100 years of support for gulags and mass murder and anti-democratic regimes, which is still, you still find this on the left, and people defending China today as though it's a revolutionary state as opposed to one of the worst places on earth in terms of politics and environmentalism. It's crucial that we prefigure our politics to some degree. Now, if in order to join our movement, you have to show that you've been vegan now for 6 weeks or whatever, that you're a card carrying radical feminist, then yeah, no, we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot. But again, you know, getting back to the question of intellectual honesty, look, I mean, now we may, so part of our disagreement here is, I think, in naming what the problem is. It's number one, we need to be able to name the problem correctly to ourselves, right, as an empirical and theoretical matter. And then the other thing is, in Gramscian terms, we need to educate the masses, working class people, and not just working class people, everybody, middle class, upper class to some extent, about the nature of social reality. Social reality, people live in an illusory condition, call it false consciousness or what, where people misunderstand the nature of the world. And I say this after teaching 20 years of college students, mostly middle class, but not only middle class. They have no idea what's going on in the world. They literally have no idea about anything. They don't know how anything in the world works. They don't know how the economy works. They don't know anything about class. They don't know that women don't really have equality. They've never heard of the word patriarchy. They don't know anything about American imperialism. Nothing, zero. So our task is to educate people and not simply to say, oh, well, you need more. We're going to give you Medicare. Well, sure. Yeah, we need to expose the mechanisms of power you dig down deep enough, central to the reproduction of power, central to the problem of oppression and violence and suffering on this planet is the human non-human relation. That is the primordial contradiction in human culture, is the fact that we create this other that, by the way, in contravention of everything we know about Darwinian continuities, evolutionary continuities, neurological continuities, biological continuities between us and other living beings, we say that those people, those persons over there, all these other non-humans, are worthy only of exploitation and death, however respectfully we do it. And then there's over here is where the real value lies, etc. So to me, it's moving deck chairs on the Titanic to have conversations about a socialism that doesn't deal with that fundamental primordial contradiction in human culture. And I feel the same way also about the gender thing, about patriarchy. Men control and run everything on the planet. Just look at the facts. So that's part of our project too, So it's like, give me one helping of impossibility, socialism, and add two more helpings of impossibility, feminism and animal rights. But man, and whatever, critical race theory and so on. But to me, that is the work that has to be done.
That's the voice of John Sanbonmatsu. He is the author of the forthcoming Omnivore's Deception. And I'm also here with Matt Huber, who has a book coming out in 2022 that's called Climate Change as Class War. Now, Matt, I'm curious. I'm really interested to hear your response. One of the things I wanted, maybe you can speak to, is the point that John makes, where you have basically the working class has aspirations for these kinds of material, affluence. And, as John and I, we had talked about, the day after Thanksgiving is a kind of, orgiastic feast of working class consumption, right? So you have that kind of challenge where, as John was pointing out, as you were pointing out too, the issue of values, what we value and how it works with regard to kind of social movements, liberation movements. So I'm wondering if you can speak to that, and also anything else that you wanted to address in John's response.
Just quickly to the I think it's very common for liberal environmentalists at universities or other type contexts to sort of look down on the orgiastic masses on Black Friday. But I think we often, again, are not quite in touch with the fact that a lot of those people are going to those sales because literally they can't afford these commodities on other days. So it's these crazy sales that get people to come out that that is actually becomes like pretty necessary for families that want to get things for their children and things like that. But going back to the kind of, I think John's absolutely right that a lot of working class people in our society are kind of deluded by the commodity form and kind of buy into this kind of consumption society and imagine themselves as, what is the phrase, temporarily inconvenience millionaires, that really that's their goal, to kind of get to this kind of abundant mass consumption, rich lifestyle. But I think that, again, is evidence of a society ruled by capital that we've been sort of producing. Really, you can say neoliberalism comes with Reagan, but I argue in my first book, Lifeblood, that is really incubating in the post-war era, which so centered around consumption and the centering of commodities and social reproduction. And so the point I try to do in that book, though, is to argue that there were these massive working class movements in the 1930s that were really clamoring for a different type of politics, which fundamentally put under question control over industrial production. And these sit-down strikes and these mass strike waves in the 30s were really putting capital's control over production on the table. And that is extremely threatening to the capitalist class. And that is why I think FDR and the New Deal order really went to great lengths to kind of give power to unions, provide federal infrastructure investment and financing of homes and cars and these kinds of things, because they knew if they could actually get the working class to actually buy into this consumer-based compromise with capital, they could leave aside the question of production. And that's what happened. And so we've been like 70 years later, we're still in this heavily consumer-oriented but I still believe that workers and working class people still are alienated in their workplaces. They still have no power in the workplace, have no power over production. And that if we can try to revive that kind of 1930s style politics that does put production on the table, that puts control over production as something workers aspire to, and not just to have their own little castle in the suburbs with a big flat screen TV, that's the direction forward. Now the direction in my only point is that the direction to that kind of working class power politics is not going to be by really sneering our noses at those people that have to buy on Black Friday or that drive a truck or something. It's just not going to, it's going to be a non-starter with those people. Now, if I have time to talk a little bit more about these more philosophical things, I think John's totally right that you can see human domination in all different types of societies, of women, of nature, and not just capitalist societies. And there's this fundamental kind of forms of power and domination that predate capitalism that we need to reckon with. Now, I don't think I'd go as far. I mean, I think from a more, I wouldn't even call it Darwinian, but just a sort of more realist ecological view. I mean, we do have to acknowledge that ecosystems have death in them. there are some species that kill others, and that's just I think, you know, a lion, if it went and tried to kill me right now, would not feel too bad about it. But that's just how nature sometimes works. And so I'm not willing to go as far as to say that humans can never kill another being or have, you know, ultimately agriculture is a kind of domination. And we're not going to be able to abandon agriculture. But I do think, again, that, again, from a very traditional Orthodox view, and I include Gramsci in that view, as although a lot of people try to appropriate Gramsci as this kind of culturalist. He's actually a Leninist, he's a materialist, and he had a much more kind of sort of Orthodox Marxist that people don't recognize him for. From a standard Marxist point of view, you know, a historical materialist point of view, the working class was going to be the last class that really created the conditions for not just human emancipation, well, actually for human emancipation. And that included women, and that included all forms of different ethnic groups that were dominated by other forms of societies. And it was this idea of this international global proletariat that in the old anthem of socialism, the Internationale, it's meant, socialism is supposed to unite the human race, and it's supposed to liberate not just workers but all oppressed peoples all over the planet, literally. And I think the Internationale was saying in the late 19th century and early 20th, but nowadays we need to extend that kind of idea of emancipation and liberation to include nature, to include animals, absolutely. But that we're not going to get there unless we have a class that has the capacity and the power to build up a mass movement to expropriate the expropriator, which is capital. And that's the way forward. It's not that the working class is more moral or better, or class oppression's worse morally or whatever. It's that the working class has this special capacity to build this kind of power to take on capital.
That's the voice of Matt Huber, right here on the Peace and Social Justice program. Matt, I had some thoughts about the exploitation of nature or the, you know, predation relation in the context of its being natural. And therefore, there's the implication that there's something that's morally okay about that because it's natural. And I think, right, you know, that's always right, a danger to head down that path. And Matt, I'm not saying that you're saying something like anything that is natural is good. Of course, you know, the fact that we're Zooming and during the time of pandemic would indicate that we don't think that, you know, viruses should just run free. But my point is that I do think we do have to qualify when we talk about natural relations, because, you know, look, there's a difference obviously between a lion who's going to eat me, who thinks not twice about eating me because he's or she is hungry, and me as a human moral agent, if you will, making decisions that I understand the consequences of, which are, you know, suffering, unnecessary suffering, and things like domination and violence and stuff. So I just wanted to put that out there and just sort of clarify where that part of what you were saying, Matt. But John, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to say was what you just said, which is that I think, Matt, that in your formulation there, you were conflating death with killing, and those aren't the same thing. First of all, death is part of life. If my neighbor comes in with a knife and says, well, you know, it's just part of the circle of life, you know, killing, you know, tries to kill me, I say, no, I'm sorry, it's not today. Try me tomorrow. So the lion is an obligate carnivore. Now, proto-moral behavior, quote unquote, there's a lot of ethological research now showing, without a question, that in many species have a sense of fairness, reciprocity, and also many different species are capable of empathy with others and will even self-sacrifice, will commit altruistic acts to prevent another being from suffering, even outside their species. So humans don't have a monopoly on these things. But to kind of second what you were saying, Robert, I mean, we have to indeed avoid what philosophers call the naturalistic fallacy, right? Which is to say, well, what's natural is good. The question of our relations with other animals is a question of culture, of ideology, of values, absolutely. And the fact that the lion eats the gazelle has no bearing whatsoever, you know, on whether we should organize our mode of economic development and our psychic life, as I would describe it, around domination and hurting other vulnerable, sensitive beings. We have that choice that the lion doesn't have. So it just doesn't compute there. The other thing I just wanted to note is, I think what does worry me about this reversion to a kind of class politics of the 30s and 40s is that it leapfrogs over a lot of insights that we gained from feminists, from new left critics and so forth, who pointed out some of the problems with what has been called Promethean Marxism. You know, I mean, if you think of Diego Rivera's famous mural of man at the center of the atom, you know, the friendly atom, well, not so friendly atom, you know, the chemical industry, you know, churning out all this, these wonderful plastics. Look, that whole gestalt has fucked up the world so badly. And that, you know, it's not enough to just say, oh, we want to be in charge of production. Now we want a piece of the pie. We want to be in charge of Promethean man. Uh-uh. That whole project is messed up. And that is the project. So is to challenge that. And so I totally agree again that we need to be the left working class. I mean, needs to gain control over the means of production. But we can't beg the question of what kinds of production, what kinds of consumption. And we can't leave that to a rainy day. Why? Because the entire earth the living earth is disintegrating. Everything is disintegrating. We don't have the luxury of decades, centuries for the working class to gain control and to figure out what its values are. This is the worst crisis in 66 million years. It's the destruction of all mammals, avians, reptiles, amphibians, insects, fish. They are all being wiped off the face of the earth in the space of just a blink of the eye. And when I talk to working class audiences, no one knows that that's even happening. They don't, and they don't. And when I talk to audiences, working class, non-working class, people don't think that that matters. They don't understand that it matters. And they may feel a little sadness at the news, but then they want to go back to lunch. That is the project, it seems to me.
That's John Zandman Matsu, right here on the Peace and Social Justice Program. Matt Huber, I want you to be able to respond to things John had said, but also looking to solutions as if this isn't challenging enough. But you do talk about a kind of a Green New Deal, and you critique the current proposal, the Green New Deal, and the ways that it falls short. But I think we can all agree in that, as you mentioned, you know, you have this, you know, 2/3 of the population is within the working class, and so no green, quote, green revolution is going to happen without solidarity in that class. So, Matt, if you could, in your writings, you seem supportive yet critical of the Green New Deal. So can you speak to any of that?
Yeah. Directly to that question, I mean, I think the theory of change at the Green New Deal was that if you start delivering these kind of fundamental material gains to masses of working class people, that you'll start to build popular support for climate politics. It's astonishing to me that from all the kind of climate technocrat policy wonk type people, you know, who want to design really elegant like carbon taxes or cap and trade systems, they never once ask, will this policy be massively popular? and lo and behold, those types of policies are not popular at all. So But the problem with that theory of change is that if you can't deliver these material gains in the name of climate action, you're not going to start that virtuous cycle of building a mass working class politics. So when I wrote the 2019 piece, there was a lot of misplaced maybe optimism that we could build this type of Green New Deal movement around someone like Bernie Sanders. And to be frank, that failed. So now the question is, how do you start delivering these types of politics? And I'm not confident that the Biden administration has the capacity to do that. So, he's put all his climate policy in the basket of this Build Back Better Act that still has not been passed, almost a full year into office. And even if it is, it's now been whittled down so much that's mostly a bunch of tax credits to private renewable capital and other finance capital. It's just a disaster. So the other side of a working class strategy is to start working through the unions that have so much to lose by this green transition. Right now, the renewable energy industry is heavily non-union. It's based on a lot of transient, heavily exploited workers. And the developers of these renewable energy projects are vehemently anti-union, in contrast to the heavily unionized existing electric sector. So if we don't get those unions, if the unions don't realize that there's really an existential threat to their members with this green transition, and then start to build a union-led green transition, it's going to be a real big problem for them. Now, in terms of John's other points, I think I do, and we're going to totally diverge here, but I do come out of a more traditional Marxist view that sees that you have to actually have this industrial development of the productive forces to provide material conditions for emancipation for everyone, which ultimately means freedom in terms of not having to work all day to reproduce material existence. And Marx believed that it was that industrial development that actually created the conditions for that freedom. And talk about not being aware of how the world works. I feel like most people, even academics, and even environmentalists, aren't really aware of how locked in we are to an industrial mass production society. The stat I often give my students is, in 1900 in the United States, 40% of people worked on farms and were in agrarian production, and now it's 1.5%. So we've literally completely taken an agrarian society where most people are producing through agriculture and completely created an almost fully proletarianized society where most people rely on market commodities for their survival. And so in that context, I think a socialism would want to actually we can't just reject in total industrial development. We have to figure out how we can, again, harness that system to develop it in more ecologically sustainable ways. And I won't say respect nature again, because that raised concerns, I appreciate, Robert, you like bringing this up, because I'm not trying to say that it's natural that we must kill, that we are killers. But I did want to say that in a kind of more historical materialist sense, there's just a material fact that we have to reproduce our existence through, we don't want to call it killing, but through the interchange with the natural world. And that, I think I would just be on a side where that was more flexible in terms of how that material interchange was arranged. And I really think John's right that humans are different. We are moral creatures. We have this kind of consciousness, and Marx talks a lot about this, that we, and it's that consciousness that really gives this really human potential for a really socially democratic directed production of what Marx called the associated producers. And I like to think if we have that kind of democratic control, we would really start to design it in ways that is less destructive to nature, because a lot of that destruction, John is right, is because we're so alienated from the ecological conditions of our existence through the commodity form. And so the only solution is to build a system where we break down that alienation and bring people back into an understanding and connection with the material conditions of their existence. And we got to be flexible, because democracy is hard. We don't know what people want in terms of what they want their lives and their production to look like.
John, I know you have to jump off. Do you want to say any parting words?
Yeah, well, first of all, I really want to thank both of you. It's been a very lively and interesting discussion. And I get the feeling we could go on for quite some time. I just want to say that, we are indeed locked into this overly technological and industrial order to a large extent. But that doesn't mean that I think that we should just accept it. And, you know, there's been a lot of work done in the philosophy of technology, you know, for 100 years, you know, or more, going back to Lewis Mumford and on through Jacques Ellul and, Marcuse and so on. Really taking a normatively critical look at technological domination as a problem and industrialization as a problem. And again, I'm very uncomfortable with any Marxist conception that that defers the question of the values, particularly as insofar as they're heavily embedded in systems of domination and mass violence, both to humans and to non-humans. So that conversation, I really feel it's important that we not simply just say, oh, well, yeah, we're just going to seize the means of production and assume that they'll be more or less like this, except that people will vote on how they want to organize it. We know that democracy is a very important value, but it isn't the only value, you know, and we've had, if I live in a society where everyone votes to take away women's right to an abortion or to oppress minorities, I'll be on the side of the people who are being oppressed regardless. And so, you know, I'm not in favor of any flexible outcome that continues our mass violence against other sensitive beings. And I think that I just don't see any rationale for it. And that's the kind of conversation, again, I think we need to have before the revolution, not after the revolution. But anyway, I do have to run. But thank you again, both of you so much, and to be continued.
Well, John Senbanatsu, thank you very much. So, Matt, did you want to say any parting words?
No, I agree with that. I really like John's points about you know, principles matter, and if we were going to create a better society, it might be worth sort of saying that society would have to be formed with some sort of political constitution, which is a charged word in our society, but a sort of constitution that lays out fundamental rights, right, and fundamental principles that cannot be subject to vote or majority rule. So I think, again, we've lived in the society where the economic realm is never allowed to be subject to democracy and never allowed to be a subject of collective control. So I think he's right. We should be having these conversations before the revolution to try to think about what a really democratic society would look like, and issues of principle, issues of moral, fundamental ideas of rights, I think needs to be right at the core of it.
Well, thank you, Matt T. Huber. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Peace and Social Justice Program. We'll look forward to your book coming in 2022, Climate Change as Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet. That's coming out on Verso Books in May of 2022. Matt T. Huber, thank you so much for joining us on the Peace and Social Justice Program today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really fun.
Whoa! In me, oh, things ain't what they used to be. No, no, where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy, me.
FedEx extra vehicle of yours, the one you're trying to sell, you could always donate it to KZFR. We'll use the proceeds to bring you more of your favorite public radio programs. It's easy. Here's how to get started. You can call our vehicle donation support team at 888-593-7288. Available 7 days a week to take your call at 888-593-7288 and donate.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Pearl Consulting, offering digital branding and marketing to attract and connect with your ideal client. From websites and logos to social media, owner Sarah Fontaine provides comprehensive branding solutions for your online presence. To bring you the business you're looking for, visit pearlconsulting.tech or call 530-588-7505 to get started. Peace and Social Justice is also brought to you by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com.
Thank you, Robert. It's just a minute before 1 o'clock here on KZFR. My name's Ray, host of Playing Dead. Happy New Year's Eve. Of course, we got a New Year's show for you today. I almost didn't, but, you know. Nice little Scarlet on the background there to get us going. Let's get right to it. Got a mashup. We're going to do a 86 countdown. And then a nice long set from the bonus New Year's Eve set of 1981. So, fun stuff coming up. Let's thank our underwriters, and we'll get right into it. We want to thank Chico Natural Foods, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The Co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brewed coffee. The Co-op now accepts online orders and curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods is open every day at the corner of 8th and Main Street in downtown Chico. We also want to thank Payroll Plus. Owner Dolly Wendell and her staff provides payroll, workman's comp, group health insurance, employee benefits, and human resource management services consistent with the ever-changing employee tax laws and compliance. Dolly and Payroll Plus can be reached at 566-0452. And of course, we got a show tonight. That's right. Dead Awake at the Women's Club, New Year's Eve, Blue Egyptians, and more. Can't turn my head around all that way. But I think we're going to have a special guest later today in the program. Let us know more about that, and we'll be talking about that throughout the show. So, go get a nap, do some stretching, get ready to party down at the Women's Club at New Year's Eve. Two full sets from Dead Awake. Alrighty, let's get to it. As promised, we're going to start off with a little countdown action. If everything goes just exactly right.